Welcome to Local Talk Wednesday on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in our seven-county listening area in central Iowa. Welcome to our hosts, Gina McAndrews, Paul Wearson, and Susan Franzen.
Thank you, Mike. Great to be here today with Paul and Susan. We're winding up our membership drive with a great program. As we recover from our trauma of COVID, we're revisiting some of our favorite road trips from the last few years. And these road trips are, they're just exactly the reason why we love KHOI. They represent the people and stories of our local area, and that's what we really enjoy most. I certainly enjoyed listening to them last night as we organized the scripts. The first one that was requested was, Paul really liked Lake Robbins, and I know that's really a great place. We still go down there several times to go dancing during the year when COVID's not around. And I'm sure you've been down there a few times, Paul.
Right. You know, that was probably my all-time favorite road trip because it dates back so far, you know, and the glory days of Lake Robbins Ballroom span way back to the earlier part of the 20th century. And when you walk in there, you're just cast into a whole realm of nostalgia. In my mind's eye, I saw GIs and Navy people home on leave dancing at Lake Robbins to big band music during the war. And there's a lot of memorabilia down there, a lot of posters from old shows. Dorothy Lamour played there. It was just terrific. And so you go in there and you're just confronted with all this history, and the place is huge, and it's right out in the middle of cornfields. It's kind of unique that this unique, wonderful place is situated right out there in the middle of farm country. And of course, back in the day, I think there was even a commuter railroad that took people up to that area from the Des Moines area. But it was nostalgic. And of course, I was also very impressed that this woman was preserving that as a business and carrying it into modern day. So that was one of my favorite road trips of all time, Lake Robbins Ballroom.
Yeah, she even had the owners. It started in 1931, if I remember correctly, because when I first started going there, 30 years ago or so, there was a lady named Kip, and she was in her 80s or 90s then, and she was still working there. And she had started in 1931 collecting tickets when she was, I think, 16 or 17. It was her high school job, and she did it up until she was close to 100, I think.
Yeah, she was a lifetime employee at the place, and that's what you call employee loyalty, okay? You're there for most of your lifetime in a ticket booth, and she, like the whole building and the dance floor, was part of an institution there. So that's one of the great stories associated with Lake Robbins Ballroom. But all the famous names and bands that played there just showed you the access to live entertainment back in the early radio days, back before television and some of the mass media we have today, where people right here in central Iowa could see some of the most noteworthy names in the entertainment field. Life was smaller then. You had greater access to big names because they toured everywhere. These people were on the road, and they toured Lake Robbins as well as the big ballrooms in the cities. So it brought live entertainment to central Iowa at a time when, and especially during the Depression, you know, in the World War II era. And it was must have been fabulous for those people to have access to that quality of entertainment right in the middle of central Iowa.
Right. Yeah, and I think there used to be a lake there as well, even though now it's all cornfields.
Right. Yeah, there was a lake also, and I think some accommodations for people beyond just the ballroom. It was as described to Susan and I when we were there, it was kind of a complex of buildings, and there were a lot more surrounding landscaping going on, and more of an attractive place probably outdoors than it is now. But
right.
So much of the original decor and the elements of what was going on and seen by the people back in the World War II era is preserved there. So it really is like walking into it's like time travel, I guess. You walk in there and it's a different era. So
yeah, it's really nice. Boy, you sure don't see those big dance floors anymore like you used to. I mean, it's probably, how many square feet do you think that is? 10,000?
Well, I don't know how many people could dance on that floor, but it's as big as I think any of the great ballrooms of the era, because
yeah,
if you worked out the square footage, it would probably be on a par with anything existing in the United States at that time. It's
and
huge.
We do have the audio of the Lake Robbins from Susan, but we lost Susan in the meantime. So just I wanted to make you guys aware of that.
Well, maybe we could play that, Mike. What do you think?
All right. You ready to do it?
We're ready. Let's hear what about that road trip with Paul and Susan to Lake Robbins.
That thing, Lake Robbins is like a mirage in the middle of a desert. It pops up in the middle of the cornfields. And by now, let's hear why you might want to go there.
I think we ought to invite our listeners to imagine this beautiful landscape we're looking at. We're standing in front of the entrance, and there are fields really green. It's been raining a lot, so that everything is just green and beautiful. Is that corn over there?
Yeah, it's got to be corn. The main thing here is they did groom and mow all the grass around the driveway, but until you get to this area, it's strictly farm-to-market roads and farmsteads, and so this pops up on you as a real surprise. Everything is like it has been forever. It's one of those things that eludes the passage of time, because I think if you drove in here in 1940, it would be the same scene.
Well, let's get in and meet Lynn.
Oh, thank you. Let me get some lights on.
Oh, what a beautiful place. Looks like they're ready to have Ron set up the equipment.
Well, Lynn, what's the date on this building?
They opened up on November 11th, 1931.
Veterans Day, 1931.
Armistice Day. It wasn't Veterans Day then. It was Armistice Day.
That's right. And here's a stage right behind you,
yeah.
And that front's a ballroom with these excellent floors.
Yeah, this is the original dance floor.
It is.
Yeah, it's like a hard white pine, when pine was really hard.
Yes, yeah.
And it's never been replaced.
And the dance floor is fronted by the stage, and right off stage you have your bar, and then there are tables grouped all around the dance floor. And they're placed so that everybody has a good view of what's going on out there. It's actually an arena. All the way around, you have seating and tables. What's your capacity here?
We can seat over 1,000.
Really?
Or not seat over 1,000. We can have 1,000 people in here. Right now, the way it's sitting, we can seat about 400 people around the dance floor. The dance floor is 60 by 80. And there's a second bar over there. That was the original bar.
Is that right?
Yeah, and originally this was all dance floor, 10,000 square feet of dance floor. No seating, there was benches around the edges. And behind those sliding doors is another room that was the original bar that sat 200 feet south of the building.
Really?
And so you would go out and drink, and if you wanted to dance, then you came over to this building and you paid to get in to dance.
What's the background of this in terms of who created this property this way? Was there a family, a founding family?
Yeah, the farmer owned this land, and there was kind of a natural pond here. And he started in the early 20s, or I'd say by the 20s, he had a man-made lake. And he started putting cabins around it. And the interurban out of Des Moines runs right by here. And so people would come out and camp in these cabins and go on the lake. There's a photo over there. There's a picture. He put an eight-sided cabin on this lake with a boardwalk. And this was in the early 20s. And then by 29, he started building the ballroom. And his name was Robbins. And, you know, you'd think 29, the Depression and stuff, but see, the Midwest didn't get hit as soon. And he was very wealthy. He, you know, he raised cattle and took them to Omaha and was the rendering guy. And
what was his first name?
Riley.
Riley Robbins.
Yeah.
And you, what you have to call Riley is a visionary.
Yeah.
Who could come up with this concept? If you had a lake, most people would say, well, maybe we can put some cabins around it. But he went way beyond that. Now, the interurban, that was actually a railway, wasn't
it? Yes.
And so people paid a nickel or whatever. And so that's what really brought access in
right.
from outside this rural area.
Well, and actually, though, the local people at that time, you know, back then in the 30s, you didn't go very far. And so local people supported it real well.
So it was actually the local people,
yeah.
plus whoever
yeah.
came in on the interurban.
Yeah.
And then they would come out here. And we're talking now, you know, the Prohibition era didn't end till 1933.
Okay.
So there must have been interesting happenings here.
Oh, I've heard some stories.
I bet you have. The bootleggers and all.
Yeah.
Original bar.
Yeah, and it actually was in that side room. And then when they didn't let you dance and drink on the same floor. So that was the idea of the bar.
No, they didn't want to have the drinks spilled all over the floor.
No, I think it was a law.
Oh,
it was probably one of the.
And if you go to the valet, you step down.
Yeah.
Surf ballroom, you step down onto the floor. You could mm-hmm. not.
They were called blue laws,
yeah.
and they were laws that govern behavior, especially yeah. with regard to drinking. And what you have here is a place that dates back to the era of the big bands and the traveling people who actually rode in tour buses and played ballrooms all over the country. What are some of the groups that have played here?
I think almost all of them.
All the old.
I'm going through the newspaper now because where they advertise that big sign up there, that big square sign in the entranceway, is the original ad for the opening night.
Really?
And I blew it up from a little clipping. I kept blowing it up. The only thing is, we need to put a burst on there or something. Because Dorothy L'Amour was the female singer of that band.
She was.
And she was like 17 or 18 years old.
Really?
And that was in 1931. And by 35, she was making movies. She actually married the band, Herbie Kay, and they went to Hollywood. And I think he didn't get one movie that he played in. And I'm trying to find that.
But you talk about big bands, and we learned also that Les Brown and his Band of Renown,
yeah.
I understand this was one of the last dates he ever played.
He played one more date after this one. And it was really funny because people were saying, well, hope he makes it. And I didn't realize how true that was, that was a possibility, you know.
Because he was advanced in age by
yeah,
that time.
Yes, yeah. But his son had taken over the band. And his son was with him that night, you know. His son had been with him quite a few years.
Well, you think of Glenn Miller, maybe
yeah.
Harry James. These people
yeah.
were people who, you know, we lose track of the fact that television revolutionized things so much. Before that kind of mass media, you became famous by playing everywhere.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
so it wasn't unusual for bands to play that are very well known in very obscure places. It was
right.
part of the life, you know, like vaudeville almost.
Yeah. And it wasn't like, okay, every Friday or Saturday night we're going to have a dance. It was like when the band was coming through, they'd throw an ad in the paper and say, Wednesday night.
So it couldn't,
you know,
not necessarily a weekend.
No, it was just, you know, whenever they were coming through and stuff.
Date that for me. When you bought the ballroom, what was the date that you did that?
I bought it in 93, October 93.
And the previous owner, had they been involved for a long period
yeah,
of time?
Yeah, she had married the owner. The original owners were Robbins, and they had it. Nobody can seem to pinpoint it exactly, but they'd had it for the first few years, and then they kind of leased it out to the Best family. And then, you know, the war came in, and people in and out of the war, the family, you know, and stuff. And so Pete Best ended up having the ballroom and running it, and then he actually bought it. Then Wilma, his wife, was 20 years younger than him, so he'd been running it for a while, and then she married him in 44. And then they actually bought it in 46. And so he'd probably had it anywhere from 5 to 10 years before she got involved. And she was here 50 years when I bought it.
So that's the owner prior to you.
I'm the third owner.
And you're on June 28th, we have the High Society Big Band playing. And they're going to be playing Glenn Miller and all that stuff. And I'm just thinking how often this wood has heard some of those songs.
Oh, wow, a lot.
If the walls could
yeah.
talk, you know.
Yeah.
But I think the most impressive thing is, number one, the original floor and the original bar, and then all the modifications that have been made, the location of the stage and everything, the second bar.
Yeah.
This is all an improvement.
Well, the stage, that's original stage. Was
that the original stage?
Yeah. Well, it's been...
That was always located.
It's been
there.
Repaired. It was always located. I could say it's been repaired.
And now the main entrance is...
Straight through those lights. You know, going through those lights, there's a little hallway.
Wasn't there a lady who took tickets here for years? Tell me a little about her.
She was here opening night. She didn't work opening night, but she worked the next night they were open. And she was probably 23, I believe. And she started taking tickets, and I kind of inherited her. And at first I thought I could just... replace her, you know. Well, it didn't take me long to realize how valuable she was and how honest she was. She was a teacher for 20 years, and then she worked in the bank for 20 years, and then she always worked out here. And we're actually trying to get her in the Guinness World Book of Record of being the longest working person at the same place.
Mm-hmm.
And we have not... nobody's broken the record yet. She was... You know, we've got her down for 81 and three-fourths years.
Well, she's her own
And
category.
So we just have to get them to acknowledge, you know.
Yeah, that's right.
We know she's the longest working person, you know, but, you know, to submit it and get them to officially approve it.
I would regard her as a very stable person.
Yeah, honest as the day.
Well, the reason I brought her up is because I saw a television feature on her. She was interviewed.
Yeah.
As this person
about,
who had been here
about
for
5 times.
It was a delightful interview, and you could tell there was a labor of love for her forever.
Yeah.
And that she was as tied to this place as the floor is. You know?
Yeah. And we lost her last summer, the end of June. So that was so hard. She was 105 years old.
Well, let's go back to the decision-making process for you. Now, how did you come to know about and decide to buy this place?
I started working here part-time as a waitress and a bartender, and I actually worked here about 6 years, and I went back to school, and the joke was, I'm getting educated so I don't have to work this hard. But, you know, you just fell in love with it. So when we were kids, my dad followed Lawrence Welk around. He loved Lawrence Welk. And so he'd dance with us on his feet, you know, in the living room and stuff. And so when I started working here, I just fell in love with the ballroom. And I went back to school and got educated, and I was a graphic artist, and I went out east for about 10 years. And I was always looking for a ballroom out there, and they don't have them out there. We went to the Roseland in New York, you know, and stuff.
Oh, that's still there.
Well, but they've closed it down.
Did they close the Roseland?
They officially closed it down this summer, this year.
I'm sorry
about
to hear
broke
that.
My heart.
Yeah. But then finally, something precipitated your return.
Well, I wanted to keep, you know, I kept, like I said, the longer I was out there, the more I wanted to come back. And my kids had grown up, and they were going to college back here and stuff, and so why not come back home, you know?
So your kids were back here in the Midwest.
Yeah. And, well, they were out in Connecticut, but they came back to go to college here. Because
okay.
they, you know, we all miss the Midwest. So I came out here, my nephew was getting married, and I came out here, and my older brother said, remember when you worked out here and you and Judy wanted to buy this? And I said, yeah. He says, why don't you do that? I had been applying for jobs with that flood came in 93.
Yeah.
And everybody that was going to hire me wasn't hiring. And so I was looking for something else that I could do. And I said, well, I could probably do that. And so I went and talked to her, and it happened.
And you got the necessary financing and so on.
Yeah.
And you have no regrets looking back. That was a good thing to do.
Yeah, I think so.
This is Local Talk, KHOI Radio, Community Radio, Ames, Story City and surrounding area. And you're on a road trip to Lake Robbins, recorded by Susan Franson and me, Paul Wearson. And we've been talking with Lynn Paschal Wilkinson about the origins of the ballroom, its history up to the present.
Well, are you there?
Yeah, that was a glorious day, Susan. I remember that as if it were yesterday. And what a great time that was for us. And to me, it just symbolizes what our road trips were all about.
Well, I've been following them a little on, you know, with their ads. And they had New Year's again this year. And Gina, you're the only one of us who's actually danced there. Is that right? You used to dance at Lake Robbins.
Oh, yes. We used to go actually fairly frequently.
Okay. Well.
Yeah, we used to go down on, I mean, they had dances during the week and the weekends. And, I mean, there would be all ages there. It was so much fun. I mean, they even allowed little kids in there because they had a great restaurant as well. I mean, they didn't have tons of different items, but they had, you know, great burgers and fries and, you know, just your average, you know, medium kind of food, cheeseburgers and hot dogs and that sort of thing. And a huge dance floor. And, you know, even I've been there up until just two or three years ago. Was probably the last time I went. And I mean, you'd see people in their 80s and 90s and teenagers and people with young kids and families out there. And, you know, the young kids, how they used to do at wedding dances and stuff. And they'd be out there at 10 years old or whatever and kind of wiggling around and just having fun and starting their new dancing. And, you know, people would coordinate and drive down together. There was a lot of Iowa State students went down there as well.
Well, that's really interesting because I knew a lot of older people. I mean, Howard Hammond was our contact. And of course, what happened with the older people was they died. And it was kind of scary in the sense that the ballroom clientele didn't seem to be going on, but you're saying we've got new generations, right?
Yes, it was really nice. I mean, there weren't probably as many people, you know, the hundreds that were probably there before. But yes, they have some country music and they play some bands and they even had a little salsa dancing a few times, you know, merengue and that sort of thing. And they've got a great, it's just a wonderful place all the way around. But it takes, you know, from Ames, it takes probably 40 minutes or so to get there. But well worth the drive, and it's just a wonderful, nice place to go have an evening of fun and relax. And it's not so loud. Like, you go to some places today, or even some of the restaurants, that to have a conversation, you almost have to yell at each other. And there it's nice and you don't have to, it's big enough. I think that the music, if you're up by the band, you can really hear it, but you can also have a nice conversation.
Okay. Well, I think we are having this conversation because we want our listeners to find about more road trips and that they can take right here in central Iowa, a place that they might not know about and that we recommend. We hope that you know how to become members. We've been probably trying to tell you during this week, but we really all want to stress that it's very important for you to support the station. Even if you just listen to a couple programs, because those programs won't be here if we can't pay our tower rental, which is significant. And we have other, the connection to the tower is really something. It's not like we can just send the signal off the top of the Pantorium. We have a rather large building in the way, the McFarland Clinic. And so we have to go over to the Sheldon Munn and have a tower there. I don't know what the connections are now. Fortunately, I don't have to worry about that. We have some marvelous volunteers who worry about that, as well as a very small professional staff. But certainly, we need you. If you are now inclined to help us out, call us at 515-292-2878. And we do have somebody to answer the phone if that happens. And we have the easiest way is just to go to our website, khoifm.org, and find the yellow Donate, Become a Member button.
Yeah, that's right, Susan. And there are several ways you can become a member, too. You know, you have a $60 membership, the basic member. You have the household, $100 a year. Then you have the major donor of $1,000. Or you can be a sustaining member where that monthly bill is automatically devolving out of your bank account. So there are several ways to contribute. And the main thing is that we talked about Lake Robbins and preserving that. Well, KHOI is unique in that it's not only a community radio station, but one of the few stations available locally. That's the old traditional mom-and-top type operation where local people are involved as volunteers, and we cover the major issues of people. Maybe the city council meeting, the board of supervisors for the county, and basically keep you in touch with what's happening locally. Plus, we have every kind of music from opera to rap. You know, most radio stations have formats where they only play top 40 or they only play country and western. On our station, because of the variety of volunteers, we have all kinds of music. One of my favorites is Bob's 8-Track Garage Sale, where he plays music from the 70s. I love Tom Beale's show with all the great soundtracks from Hollywood. And, of course, Curtain Up, Roger Berger and Carol Horowitz, who do all the Broadway shows. So those are my have-to-listen-to programs. And that's just and beyond that is a wide variety of tastes. You can hear rap music at the same place where you hear opera. You don't see that anywhere around. So we have a unique role in the local radio culture. And the only way to preserve that, as with Lake Robbins, is for your financial support. And when you walk it down for a $60 a year membership or a household membership of $100, for the amount of time you listen to KHOI, that's like buying a cup of coffee, you know? So a little money goes a long way, and a lot of money goes even further. And we need to preserve that piece of radio culture that is KHOI.
Yes, well, thank you, Paul. As you could probably guess, the Lake Robbins was Paul's pick for the best road trip that we've taken. Regina had a pick too, and it's interestingly, it's kind of local news because we did a story about the Kate Shelley Park where the station house was, and we did a program there called the In the Footsteps of Kate Shelley, where we went throughout it. We had a tour of the Kelly Farm. So, Gina, do you want to say anything about that before we listen to it?
Yes, I sure enjoyed that trip and learning so much more about Kate Shelley when we went down to the bridge and then also when we went to the farm. And it was really impressive that, you know, people are still really care about that and they try to preserve, you know, the history and the stories. And well, I think our little audio trip will explain a lot to us and why KHOI is so important for our road trips.
I took Charles Irwin's invitation to walk in the footsteps of Kate Shelley. That's what inspired this road trip. But it was a good thing that I recorded his description of the Kate Shelley exhibit at the Boone County Historical Center last year, because it has been changed now. But the chance to walk in Kate Shelley's footsteps outside is better than ever. This year, we have the opportunity to visit the site of her home, of the bridge at Honey Creek, where the pusher train went through, and the bridge at Moingona that she crawled across. Neither of these bridges are still there, but the limestone pilings and the abutments are there, so you can get an idea of their size. And you can see, even now, with the river at a fairly low level, just how daunting it must have been to see that creek and that river in flood stage. And we have the opportunity to visit the site of her home, of the bridge on Honey Creek where the pusher train broke through, and the bridge at Moingona that she crawled across. Neither of those bridges are still there, but the limestone pilings and abutments are there so you can get an idea of their size and just how wide Honey Creek and the Des Moines River are down at Mangona, even today.
Wes, what's the best way to get there?
Just head west along Highway 30 past Boone and drive straight to the turnoff for the Enchanted Valley Tree Farm on the left side of the road, just before the bridge over the Des Moines River.
What's at the Enchanted Valley Tree Farm?
It's part of the Kate Shelley Farm, and Joe Reuter, the present owner of this land, has offered to show us what's known as the Shelley Valley on Honey Creek, and then to give us a tour of his property, which is on the hilly part of the Shelley Farm.
Here's the sign to Enchanted Valley Tree Farm, so I'll turn left here.
Joe Reuter said his road was a mile and a quarter south of the highway on Montana Road. There's the sign saying Kate Shelley Farm by that hilly land on the right. On the left, there's a golf course. I've heard of the Honey Creek Golf Course, so that must be it.
Here's the turnoff to Joe Reuter's tree farm.
Yeah, this is the place, all right. And the road we've been riding on, you say, was the railroad right-of-way, so the tracks would have
run right through here.
Okay.
You can even find cinders in here, too.
Really?
Yeah, we may find some as we get closer to the bridge.
Okay, and so now we're going to turn, though.
That's right.
And follow up where the tracks would have been.
That's
is that right?
Right. Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Watch the mud.
But right now, this says Wildlife Management Area Public Hunting. Is that's the sign that leads to the bridge?
Right. Yeah.
I mean, to the former bridge. There's no. Is there a bridge there now?
Just abutments. The abutments are still there. Stone or limestone abutments, but they're. I don't think they're the abutments from the bridge that washed out. So your tracks would be running right along here.
This is a little bit of a ridge. We have a pretty steep drop off on both sides. Had the railroad built this up, or was this just a natural ridge?
This was built up by the railroad, and we may be able to see some cinders here too.
When was the railroad abandoned down here?
In the 1930s sometime. I don't know, have an exact date. And what's interesting, if you go out here during the fall, late fall, with the modern trains running, you can hear what sounds like a diesel locomotive coming right along this right away. And that must have really been interesting in the 1930s when the steam locomotives were still running.
You mean it's like a ghost train?
That's right. You know, that's one of the legends down here, the ghost train.
Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio 89.1, where we explore the people, stories, and events in central Iowa. Gina McAndrews and Susan Franzen are your hosts, taking a road trip to the sites of the story of Kate Shelley. We've heard an account of the legendary event in Kate's own words and have walked the land she described with Joe Reuter, whose Enchanted Valley Tree Farm sits on part of the old Shelley farm.
Now we're heading back on Highway 30 to cross the highway bridge on the Des Moines River that will take us to the turnoff to Mangona. You can't miss that one because it's also the turn for Seven Oaks Ski Area.
Is this the turn right here?
Kate Shelley Park. And they've got some picnic tables out in front and a little track. It's a beautiful place for a picnic. And one of my ideas was that this would be a possible tour other people could take.
Yes, it would be real nice.
I think that's it, right?
That's right.
Well, of course, that tour is something that the Boone County Historical Society is working on. In fact, I was down to the cleanup of that park area just a couple of weeks ago, and it's going to be illustrated. I mean, they're going to have signposts and pictures, and eventually they'll be able to get into the station house again. And that's a terrific resource we have right here in central Iowa. In In case you just tuned in, you're listening to Local Talk on KHOR. Gene McAndrews, Paul Gerson, and I, Susan Franzen. We've been bringing you samples of some of our favorite road trips. Our idea is to introduce you to some places you might have overlooked. We picked Lake Robbins because it is a real hidden treasure. Gina, I think you're the only one who's actually gone dancing there, but it's great for people of all ages, as you testified a little bit earlier. Also in the news, I mean literally in the news, because it was closed for a while, it's Nyland Corner. So, Paul, you know that better than anybody because you used to go there for lunch. Do you want to
Right, I'm a real fan. I'm a real fan, and I remember when we went over there, the woman was running that business, not only the, well, of course, there's the old gas station, and you look in there, and it's just like it was 1930 yesterday. All the stuff is in there that's vintage equipment you'd see at a gas station. And, of course, there's the diner and a small number of cabins, little hotel rooms that are maintained there, too. And the Nyland Cafe has your typical diner menu. I go there for their great hot beef sandwich. And, of course, there's sandwiches of all kinds and homemade pies. And, of course, the first thing we found out when we went there is this tremendous organization and people, sort of a cadre of people, who are devotees of the old highway system, Route 66, Highway 30, the Lincoln Highway. And a lot of these enthusiasts stop by the Nyland Cafe because it's right on the Lincoln Highway. And I'm sure they're impressed with the Nyland Cafe because it takes you back to the original Highway 30 or Lincoln Highway that existed so long ago. So I enjoyed that road trip, and I thought the woman who was running that was really founding a great enterprise, too.
Well, of course, that woman isn't running it anymore, as you probably know from the Des Moines Register. It has been closed for a while, but it has been sold, and I'm not sure that they have all of the great memorabilia. I looked at the picture that I saw in the paper. Didn't look like the way I remember it when we had lunch there. But I'm sure that they will continue the vintage feel because that's what it's about. I mean, but as you'll hear from the road trip that we took, they've got people coming from all over the world to Nyland's Corner. Do you want to play that, Mike?
Well, now that the Lincoln Highway is no longer the major east-west highway, people have to come off the new Highway 30 to get here. So do people have much trouble finding you?
I don't think so. I think it's for many people, it's a very intentional stop. We have visitors, if you browse through the guest log, from all the states and actually various countries, find their way here and are specifically looking to pay us a visit from either they've heard word of mouth or have done the research. The Lincoln Highway is actually well labeled on Google Maps, so you can type that in as a search and find the path and, you know, attractions that will pop up and so forth. And then the Iowa Lincoln Highway Association has done a fantastic job of getting working with the DOT and the RC&Ds, which manage the Heritage Byway, to get the signs up that really have helped it along. We got those up just in time for the Lincoln Highway Centennial. And then, of course, I've paid for some other advertising signage as well.
And the Lincoln Highway Centennial was last year?
It was in 2013, and we have an exciting year coming up again next year, the Jefferson Highway Centennial. And this is the crossroads of the two. The Lincoln is very well known. You know, there's been the PBS show and a number of wonderful books exploring it. But the Jefferson's a little lesser known, but hopefully that'll be changing with the additional publicity of the centennial. We just had a couple through from Michigan that were traveling the entire length, and they actually mentioned that they were traveling to Lincoln and had stopped here.
Really?
Picked up a brochure off our counter, just like many people do, and became aware of the Jefferson and kind of put that on their list for, let's do that sometime. So they just finished that a couple weeks ago. The Jefferson goes from Winnipeg, Manitoba, and makes its way down to this point, and then it follows its path the rest of the way to end in New Orleans. So it's lesser known just for the reason that back when the roads were being constructed and the routes and named and paving going on, there were associations at that time to sort of canvas for paving the roads and for a particular route over another, and then those associations sort of died out when their usefulness for that those purposes was taken care of. And then in Iowa, actually in Ogden, Iowa, the Lincoln Highway Association at the national level was reborn in Ogden about 25 years ago. So then they had a new purpose to preserve and educate, and their purposes had changed. And that's part of the reason I think that the Lincoln is better known. The Jefferson just reformed its association about 4 years ago. Actually, in Ames, they had their first international conference. In Iowa, the Jefferson comes down from the Minnesota border following, roughly, Highway 65, although there's some older routes and so forth that are being documented. And then at the Reed and Island corner, it makes a curve and goes in with the route of the Lincoln, and they go from here in Colo to Ames following the same route, and then the Jefferson then splits and heads south on Highway 69 to go to the Missouri border. The Lincoln roughly parallels 30 in some parts where the new signage is up. It's actually one and the same, but it's not a given that it's Highway 30 all across the United States. Out west, you have sections where it's following US 50. The numbered highways always come after the named, because that, of course, was the Department of Transportation's efforts to regulate and standardize and make things understandable and not have people following signs on poles to figure out where they're going.
Now, this is known as the Reed and Island Corner.
Correct.
And for those who are listening, there's a marvelous diner here, plus an old gas station with all the old pumps, and then a hotel on the other side.
A motel.
A motel, yes, that's a 20th century term. And inside the restaurant, Nellie, is our homemade food, which is really an attraction. We just had lunch there. And then also on the walls, you've got a marvelous display of historical matter, you know, all of the pictures and illustrations of the old Highway 30. So if you come to the Nyland Reed Corner, you'll be treated to history as well as very good food.
Sandra, you have a key. Can you take us into
the
gas station?
Yeah, let's go in.
As also, we see signs for the Jefferson and also the Greyhound lines, and often gas stations in places like this were also bus pickup points and bus stations.
Absolutely. In its heyday, the Reed and Island Corner was going full tilt.
Well, I think we're through with our visit to New Island Corner. When we stopped there, it was interesting that in addition to the people who came from around the world just so they could go to the Reed Island Corner, that a lot of the customers were from Colo. They had bridge groups that came up and played there in the afternoon. They had people who just had come up for lunch because it was such a popular local place. And now we have a little clip. It's a place that you can, well, I guess you can visit, but no one does. It's Lake Comar, which is another historical spot from the 30s and earlier, I believe. This is a memory from Kay Munson, who still lives in Story City, and she was a child swimming star at Lake Comar. And could you play that, Mike?
Now we're in Kay Munson's apartment, looking at the photos in her book, Lake Comar, as she describes summers at Lake Comar in the 1920s and 1930s.
It sounds like it was a wonderful, wonderful place to cool off, to be entertained, to enjoy with your friends, and in an amazing time. Could you talk just a little bit about the 20s and the 30s? And what was happening then, and how why Lake Comar was important.
For one reason, there just were not lakes in central Iowa. So any size body of water was unusual. And so that attracted people, the fact that they could swim.
One thing that many of our listeners may not have vividly in their minds is what it was like in the summer in Iowa in the 20s and the 30s. You had no air conditioning. Probably most people didn't even have fans, is that right?
Well, we didn't have a fan in our house, and it was very hot, and particularly in a few years in the mid-30s, it was over 100 degrees, I remember, one summer for 2 weeks. So it was very hot, and to go to Comar, it seemed like it was 10 degrees cooler because there were a lot of trees there. And then there was that body of water as well. And then a place to swim and get cooled off. Sundays was a big day for swimming. Many people didn't have a suit. So they would rent suits at Comar and swim. Hot weather, but we'd drive to Comar. It seemed like it was 10 degrees cooler. There were a lot of shade trees there. And then you could go swimming and cool off. The big activity at Comar was on Sundays when they had live entertainment. There was radio, but radio was just in its infancy in the 20s. Even in the late 20s and early 30s, a lot of people didn't have radios, or they had these small table ones. To have live entertainment was very special. And Fred Cornelissen scheduled the live entertainment, started in the winter, scheduling his groups. But he had wholesome entertainment. Any parent could feel free about their children going out and seeing the entertainment that was there. Usually every summer the Carl King Band would come from Fort Dodge. I remember there was a gymnastic group from Ames that came up because my sister was so interested in that. There would be players that would go from place to place that would present short plays. And then musical, a special musical entertainment. There was a stage for the performers, but the rest of the area, for people to watch the entertainment, there were bleachers they could sit, and they could sit on the ground. But we needed to have good weather for that Sunday in order to enjoy the entertainment, which was in the afternoon and in the evening. And if it was a rainy Sunday, then, of course, that reduced the crowds greatly. To be successful, they needed good Sundays to make the money because there was live entertainment, but there were also a place to buy ice cream and candy bars and hot dogs. Every other year, they had the 4th of July celebration out there. Amazingly, on Sundays, men were wearing suits and coats. Of course, if it was hot, they took their suit coat off, but they'd have on shirts. There was no casual jeans worn at that time. They just were dressed as they would have been dressed for church in the morning. During the depths of the Depression, we did with what we had and enjoyed what we had. But most people could pay that 25 cents for a car to go to Comar on Sunday. Now, there was no charge during the week. People could come in and have picnics and use the facilities, however they would pay to swim. But at any rate, they would be free to use the picnic grounds. So it was a great place for recreation at very low cost during a time when people had so little money.
What ended it?
I think that radio had an effect as it became more popular and people would listen to radio programs. They didn't feel the need for the live entertainment on Sundays. Having a summer with rain on Sundays, I'd say maybe you would say a third of the Sundays, that really takes out the profit. Fred found out that the water, this artesian well water, would be excellent for growing goldfish. So he was experimenting with that while he was continuing with the programs at Comar. And then he would raise special kinds, you know, there are many varieties, special kinds of goldfish. The water at Comar was the same temperature winter and summer, and it was rather unusual. So he was able to have small ponds to grow the goldfish using this artesian well water. So he had a truck, and he would go to, at that time, to dime stores where they were selling goldfish, and goldfish were popular. And so he would go to Kansas City, to Omaha, to Minneapolis, selling the goldfish. So that's how he made a living. People could still go there and swim, but at their own risk. And the golf course was open until World War II. Then it was plowed up for crops. And that was really the end, when the golf course was plowed up.
Let's drive back to Ames, listening to a barbershop quartet singing In the Good Old Summertime. This is dedicated to Roy Warman and the Ames Barbershop Quartet.
I think that we cut that off. Actually, there's a problem when you pick out your old favorites unless you listen to every word, because the story that I remember best about Lake Comar and Lake Kay Munson was when she was 5 years old. She was out there a lot. Her parents were friends of the owners of Lake Comar.
I need to talk a little bit about Kay. She was the darling mascot of the Lake Comar. She was a little diver. She just put on an exhibition out there. And at one time, Johnny Weissmuller, who played Tarzan in the movies, had an exhibition out at Lake Comar. They had a golf course. They had a skate rink. They had a lagoon where you could paddle around in a canoe. They had all the things that Kay described. And as a matter of fact, I live on a farm 2 miles south of Story City, and I could barely see a copse of trees over in the distance. That's the only remnant of Lake Comar, that copse of trees. And for a long time, that was surrounded by a little lagoon, but I think they've shut down the artesian well there now. But for years, all that was left, and still are, is that big copse of trees. But what it was a unique place, artesian-fed, cool water, all the people recreating and going to special events out there at Lake Comar during the hard years of the Depression and the 1920s. And it was really quite an enterprise, and Kay was the star in that. As a matter of fact, I think very soon in June, we'll be celebrating her birthday. She's coming back to Story City at the museum, and we're going to have, it might be her 98th birthday party. So Kay is going to be a celebrity again. The little diver from Lake Comar is now in her 90s, and we're going to celebrate her birthday soon.
Well, this is true. Central Iowa nostalgia. But we have one last clip that I'd like to play. And it's a different kind of entertainment that has sort of come and gone since some of the others. You'll hear the story on the clip. Mike, to put it in. We went up to Worcester Theater because it was threatened. It was about to close, and all the theaters had similar threats, but theirs was the worst.
Hi, this is Carrie Rojas, and I'm calling from Webster City.
Wow. Well, I recently read an article in the Ames Trib about your theater. Sounds like you have a real story to tell.
It's been a pretty exciting time up here, and we just opened our doors 2 weeks ago. So, yeah, it's been a wild ride, and
the whole community has gotten behind reopening the theater, and a thing that's very exciting for us.
I think you need the backstory on that. What happened to the theater? Why was it closed? What happened to Webster City? Not everybody would know.
Well, the first thing that happened is that we lost a major employer, and hundreds of people were out of jobs. And in a town of about 8,000, when you lose a business that size, then it starts to affect your Main Street businesses as well, because people don't have money to spend. And so a year and a half ago, the theater filed bankruptcy and closed. And so it was one of 12 empty storefronts on Main Street. And I think the closure of the theater was like the final straw for some people. And they just decided that Webster City was not going to be written off as dying. I believe there was a TV station in Des Moines that actually reported that Webster City was dying, and that kind of fed into this. And so a group of people formed a nonprofit board to see if they couldn't buy the theater and get it reopened. And the name of the board is HERO, Help Entertain and Restore Organization. And we've had heroes all across Webster City at all levels. People have donated time and talent and money. And the first big thing was they restored the marquee, and it's just gorgeous. And then on the 19th, we opened our doors.
And what was the first movie that you showed?
We showed Guardians of the Galaxy in 3D.
3D, so you really moved upscale right away, right?
Yeah, and I think that's part of the backstory of why these Main Street single-screen theaters are closing. I mean, the owners have come to a crossroads where they either have to invest, you know, $250,000, or they have to close their doors. Because for a while, the movie studios made their shows, continued to make them available on film. But now you cannot get a show on film. You have to have digital capabilities. And the projector itself was $90,000. Yeah, I mean, it's kind of scary. And so if you don't have 8,000 people in Webster City, everybody putting in their dollars and pennies and everything they have, you can't have the kind of money it takes to reopen it.
Who did you buy it from?
We bought it from the bank. Wells Fargo had it.
I see.
We made some phone calls, and so they were we were able to get it at a very good price. You know, it took a while, but we were able to get it, and that, you know, that was the first big step. And a lot of people were like, I don't know if you can do it. Well, we have. And so now the next thing is, will they continue to support it by coming? And your earlier guest was talking about the price of getting the movies and the price of concessions. And we're really trying hard not to price gouge, to make it not just affordable to be here, but really also to have an atmosphere where people go, that's where I want to go on Friday or Saturday night or on Sunday. We're showing a family movie through tomorrow night, Dolphin Tale 2, and the turnout from the community has just been astoundingly supportive. And so that makes us real hopeful that we're going to be able to keep this thing open and going.
Well, this sounds like a really heroic story. So thank you so much for telling us this, Carrie. Do you have any more questions you'd like to ask her?
Well, I just wanted to clarify, it's mostly volunteers who do all the work up there. Is that right?
That's all we're going to be able to fit into this hour. Do you guys want to take us out?
You've been listening to KHOI Local Talk Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. We've been your hosts, Gina McAndrews, Paul Wearson, and Susan Franzen. This morning's Local Talk will not be rebroadcast at 7 p.m. Last Wednesday's show was not rebroadcast in the evening, and we felt that Jefferson and Jewel deserved to have more airtime. You can listen to today's Local Talk and all of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. There you will also find information about our guests along with relevant links to today's stories. Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a show. If you would like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 515-292-2878. That's 515-292-2878. Or contact us through our website at khoifm.org. That's also what you need to know to contact us if you decide to become a member, or you can renew your membership today. Just go to the website and hit the Donate Become a Member button. We really do need your support and hope you will become a member or donate to us this week. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.